your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Our chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Well, what we're going to be covering tonight on during this first hour is going to be a lot of seemingly disconnected types of topics, ideas, and events. But I'm going to try to paint a picture. You could say a mosaic, maybe refine it, make it a little more resolution based in the end, to try to give you a little bit of an idea as to what went on during the 20th century, and now we're into the 21st century now, and how the average American is starting or trying to deal with all the propaganda that is being thrown at them. We have the media giants that have resolved into about six different major conglomerates or corporations. And so they're all echoing about the same thing. And what I see out there, simply put here, and this is simplifying things, is that we have the left and the right, the Democrats and the Republicans, but they're being controlled by the big money, both sides. So neither side wants to take down the Fed like Ron Paul wanted to do. This is the thing that actually we should start trying to think in terms of. The Fed was created in 1913, founded, and it actually began to be a tool of your elites, your national elites, and then also your world elites. It was put together by American and European interest, and still owned by these types of interest. So when they begin to dominate the money system, then they begin to dominate in a lot of other areas of the country. Early on, we had a change in our education. We had a change in just the way that people were thinking about a lot of different things. We had a collective left that began to be nurtured. Because of the dynamic of the Bolsheviki Revolution, we had the Wilson administration in there that was anti-war at first, but then corralled the American public to go to war during the First World War. We had the formation of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York City in the 20s, 21, 22. We had a lot of things going on like that that began to consolidate the power of these national and world elites over our country. Now, I'm going to play a clip here that came from the President Trump's inauguration. It's a very short clip, but it sort of sets out to what we're beginning to see the two sides coalesce into, one of American first, and the other one is nationalist, globalist first, you could say. But let me play that clip and see what you think about it. Here's that clip in just a second. Here we go.
We assembled here today are issuing a new decree to be heard in every city, in every foreign capital, and in every hall of power. From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first. Every decision on trade, on taxes, on immigration, on foreign affairs will be made to benefit American workers and American families. We must protect our borders from the ravages of other countries making our products, stealing our companies, and destroying our jobs.
There you go with that clip from the inauguration of President Trump. And what he did was he set out then, actually what happened was Bannon, who wrote much of his, conceptualized many of his ideas on the campaign trail, enabled Trump to reach out and to touch the hearts and really fulfill the broken dreams of Americans that had never been realized. And what the Americans did was they responded to those hopes and dreams that President Trump was espousing. As he began to organize his presidential staff and so forth, and go, you know, organizing to go into the White House on the 21st, he began to collect around him some neocon types that he was not fully aware of. The number of people staffing the White House and all those upper levels is about 4,000 or 5,000 people. He started employing people that were actually not truly in support of President Trump. So what he's had to do here lately is that they had an influence in his first 100-plus days in office. And what he's had to do since then is sort of retrench and fall back to a little bit different position. And I think Bannon today, Steve Bannon, is becoming more influential. And he sort of had a falling out there and was not relying on Bannon. But I think Bannon is beginning to be more influential with President Trump today. And also, President Trump is beginning to be more seasoned in the office of the president. See, so he came from a corporate type of structure, more of a command from the top down structure, and he's got to get used to delegation of authority to people on lower levels from the president's office. And also, these people are not going to do and execute quite like you want. As far as your ideas go and your wishes, even if you're the president. Everyone has a little bit of their own mind. And so they're going to execute these orders and carry out these types of presidential wishes in their own way. What is arising here is something that is quite dynamic. At the turn of the century, the 20th century, you had some people were described as isolationists. Later on, they would be called American Firsters and an American First Council that resisted our entry into World War II. That was squashed when Pearl Harbor occurred, and boom, the American First Council was pretty well over in history. But the two sides that I see that have evolved and so forth over that 100-plus years, with the whole 1900s on into the 20th and finishing the 20th century, and now we're into the 21st century, has been, we've got two major ideas here, cultural and political ideas. We have a left that has been cultivated and nurtured through our school system, and the Soviets and the Russians and the collective left, and a very, very liberal, extremely liberal left, democratic elements within the elements of that party. And then we have a right that's coming from the Republican side. Both sides have always been manipulated from behind the scenes by the ultra-capitalist. And what is going on today, and it's very, very apparent, and it's obvious what is going on, is that this ultra money, you could say, has been building here lately a very, very fierce opposition and attack mechanism, you could say, monster against Trump. When Trump espoused that American First idea, they don't want that. They want to dominate worldwide. They're from a global viewpoint. People that took over the Fed in 1913 and have dominated our foreign affairs are globalists, and they're internationalists, And they don't care a flip about America or what America stands for. That's why there's been attacks on several levels. There were constitutional attacks coming out of the Ivy League schools, saying that the Constitution was old and it was archaic, needed to change with the culture and respond to what the people wanted and so forth. There was the other side with the strict constructionist side that said, that Constitution says what it says and we should still abide by it. See, yes, there have been modern technological changes, that occur. But the strict constructionist says those specific words written should be adhered to as much so as possible. The other side about the Constitution is one of a social and moral relativism overall. I mean, that's actually the type of ideas coming in through our school system have been one to socialize and to collectivize our schools into a collective type mindset. And in that collective mindset has been a very strong dose of social and moral relativism fed to our students. Situation ethics and my truth is my truth and your truth is your truth. And these are the kind of ideas that you run into from your average university student today. Francis Schaeffer said years ago, he used to describe the modern student today as more of a secular humanist, okay? But if you look to see how that conditioning or influencing the state has accomplished those goals, you could say, or how and what is behind that influence, and what are the mechanisms, I should say, behind this influence and this, you know, of cultivating a more collective left, progressive left state, is that you look at our public broadcast system and you look at our NPR, National Public Radio, and they're espousing humanism in about three different types of categories. It's sort of a secular humanism, it's a religious humanism, and a scientific type of humanism. Some of the programs on PBS, I must admit, are very, very interesting. And so they put forward in their programming, and the NPR interviews can be insightful also. But the overall scheme actually is supporting the progressive, collective, democratic left, and that's what I see overall. Now, your arts people, your artsy type people, especially in your musicians community, musicians type of communities, are almost all collective, socially progressive leftist Democrats. Okay, they seem to, Hollywood seems to espouse those kinds of things, and so as a result, you're going to get from the very, very collective left more of your artistic type of producers. I mean, you look at your directors and producers and all that that come out of Hollywood and so forth. So what Trump does, Trump was espousing some very principled ideas during his campaign. This does not mean, though, that Trump himself adheres to or has some of those principles. I think that deep down, and I think this is one of the sincere things about Trump, is I think he cares about the country much more so than Obama. Some people would say Obama had very great hatred for America because of his ethnicity and his upbringing in Hawaii and the influence of his real father and so forth. So others would say that that Trump deep down has a love for America. Otherwise, he has some ethical problems in the past. He's made a lot of money, so money has been a big drive for him. His ego state is continually a problem. I see him maturing into a much more presidential type of person now versus an ego-based president. So he's maturing in the office, and so he is beginning to learn and pick up on a more diplomatic way. He's always had ability to make deals in his real estate dealings, see. And he's beginning to apply some of those things. You can see now that in his foreign policy, he's beginning to make demands that are not very realistic. I think this is part of his deal making, where he'll go out and he'll demand from another country something that's obviously not that feasible or so forth. And then he'll go to the negotiation table and someone will whisper in his ear and he'll open up to something not totally different, but something totally amenable to his opponent or or the foreign ambassador or whoever that he's dealing with. His recent trip to France shows that he's very susceptible to pomp and circumstance, so he likes that. So that ego type of thing, see. And so he's got to be careful in that area also. He kept saying on the campaign trail that he's going to clean out the swamp, see. Kind of clean out that swamp. Well, I'm going to give, we're going to talk briefly here about this money problem that we have out here. And one of the examples that came up about this swamp and all these vested interests and so forth in Washington have to do with money, big money, see. In fact, BlackRock supported Hillary in the campaign, 2016 campaign, and they're managing $4.5 trillion. Yes, that's not billion, that's trillion with a big capital T. So the money power, it has overwhelming, and especially to most of your politicos in Washington, D.C. But I'm going to play here a brief, clip, and it's an interview with John Corzine. He was head of the MF Global Investment Company that finally went bankrupt in about 2011 or so, and then they resolved it through lawsuits, resolved a settlement in the vicinity of 2014. And then I'm going to play that clip, and then we're going to talk a little bit about how this thing was resolved. And actually, there was a misuse of customer funds that were invested in that company, and you just don't do that on Wall Street. You don't do that in a bank. If somebody comes in there and puts money in a demand deposit bank and you take that money and use it for something else and it's not there any longer, these are no-no. That's what actually happened in the MH Global situation. Then they blamed it on an underling that there was a woman in Chicago and she gave permission, authority to transfer some of these customers' monies over to cover an overdraft or something at the J.P. Morgan Chase, see. And so, I mean, that you begin to see that that was just sort of a scapegoat. And then the swamp covered up everything, made excuses for John Corzine, and he actually got off pretty light. So we're going to play that clip right now of John Corzine being questioned by a congressional committee. Here we go right now.
MF Global's former CEO John Corzine was under fire at a U.S. House panel, questioned as to why he said he simply did not know where some customer money, estimated to be over $1 billion by a court-appointed trustee, has gone. House Agriculture Chairman Frank Lucas.
Did you authorize a transfer of customer funds from these segregated accounts?
I never intended to break any rules, whether it dealt with the segregation rules or any of the other rules that are applicable.
Are you aware of any transfers, authorized or unauthorized, of funds out of customer accounts?
I'm not in a position, given the number of transactions, to know anything specifically about the movement of any specific funds.
The remarks were his first since MF Global's October 31st bankruptcy and his resignation days later. Investigators believe MF Global may have diverted the missing customer money for its own needs. Revelations of massive bets on European sovereign debt caused markets to lose confidence in the firm, causing a liquidity shortfall. Corzine was asked about the disclosure of some of those investments to U.S. regulators like the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, or FINRA.
It's quite possible that the beginning positions that we took in Euro sovereigns were on the books of one of our other subsidiaries, not in the FINRA regulated subsidiary.
Corzine, a former U.S. senator, New Jersey governor, and head of Goldman Sachs, also issued an apology.
And I mean this with all sincerity. I apologize, both personally and on behalf of the company, to our customers, our employees, and our investors. I truly know they are bearing the brunt of the impact of the firm's bankruptcy.
So far, neither MF Global nor any of its executives have been charged with any wrongdoing. Bobby Rebell, Reuters.
Can you believe that that questioning and answer session with John Corzine? I mean, he evaded it. He didn't give specific answers, and the questioners didn't push him that much to give special answers. Eventually, it was settled. Through court lawsuit, a large lawsuit. It was proven that monies that was taken out of customer accounts was illegally transferred to take care of an overdraft at the J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, and so. That's what the whole thing was about, but it was illegally done. They blamed it on some woman, and they said, well, she didn't intentionally do this. Well, the people know what bank accounts are customer accounts, and they know where they were transferring it to. This, I believe, is a good example. What I believe that President Trump was calling about the swamp in Washington. It's a big money system. They took over our Federal Reserve system. They found it and took it over and used it for their business dominance in 1913 onward until today, 2017. So this is the swamp that has taken over. They are up against Trump. He's not totally in their camp on all these issues and topics. And they're pressuring the hell out of them, and they're inventing stuff, just like this Russian thing, and this thing that just recently arose with, Donald Jr., okay? And we'll discuss that more in just a second. First, I want to play a Jamie Dimon clip of him addressing a question from a reporter. As he was giving a report on the second quarter's earnings of J.P. Morgan Chase. And here's what he had to say about Washington, D.C., and he really said some very, very derogatory things about that. But this is sort of the, I'm tying together the John Corzine, the J.P. Morgan. They participated in this illegal transfer of money out of customer accounts. And so later on, nobody got legally indicted for criminal charges. Yeah, 30, 40 years ago, they'd be in prison right now. Now, the swamp has gotten so corrupt that they just smooth it over. Oh, nobody intentionally did this. They didn't do this. So it resolved out in the civil court with just, fines and things like that. And they still, the settlement on it, let me tell you about the settlement on it. The settlement on it was about 93% of the customers recovered their money. That was national investors, U.S. investors. Foreign investors didn't get back but 82% approximately. So there was billions involved. It got up to a $40 billion investment firm. And so there's money missing there, there. And they didn't find them anywhere near what their losses were and so forth. Anyway, this is Jamie Dimon coming up and making a statement after a reporter asked him a question about earnings and things like that. Here we go right now.
That's great. Thank you. If I could follow up with a bigger picture question. And Jamie, you've been, correct me if I'm wrong, you've been pretty vocal about believing that the underpinnings of our economy are healthy and strong and not buying into this whole secular stagnation argument. But at what point does political dysfunction and political paralysis really start to dent that confidence? And, because you've also indicated that we do need structural reform to lift trend growth, whether it's infrastructure, tax reform, whatever it is. And, can you just comment on on that? And I guess as an adjunct to that, what are your conversations with clients like? And is there a risk that is materializing that clients are also starting to become more frustrated with the lack of progress politically?
I would look at it the other way around. So since the Great Recession, okay, which is now 8 years old, we've been growing at 1.5 to 2% in spite of stupidity and political gridlock, because the American business sector is powerful and strong and is going to grow regardless when people wake up in the morning. They want to feed their kids. They want to buy a home. They want to do things. The same with American businesses. What I'm saying is that it would be much stronger growth had we made intelligent decisions and were there not gridlock. And thank you for pointing it out, because I'm going to be a broken record until this gets done. We are unable to build bridges. We're unable to build airports. Our inner-city school kids are not graduating. You know, I was just in France. I was recently in Argentina. I was in Israel. I was in Ireland. We met with the Prime Minister of India and China. It's amazing to me that every single one of those countries understands that practical policies that promote business and growth is good for the average citizens of those countries, for jobs and wages, and that somehow this great American free enterprise system, we no longer get it. And so, you know, my view is that, and, you know, corporate taxation is critical to that, by the way. We've been driving capital and brains overseas, which is why there's $2 trillion sitting overseas benefiting, you know, all these other countries and stuff like that. So if we don't get our, you know, if we don't get our act together, we can still grow. You know, it's just, it's unfortunate, but it's hurting us. You know, it's hurting the body politic. It's hurting the average American that we don't have these right policies. And so, no, in spite of gridlock, we'll grow it. You know, we can grow at 1.5 or 2%. I don't buy the argument that, you know, that we're relegated to this forever. We're not. And if, you know, if this administration can make breakthroughs in taxes and infrastructure, regulatory reform, you know, we have become one of the most bureaucratic, confusing, litigious societies on the planet. It's almost an embarrassment being an American citizen traveling around the world and listening to the stupid shit we have to deal with in this country. And, you know, at one point, we all have to get our act together or we won't do what we're supposed to do for the average Americans. And unfortunately, people write about the thing like it's for corporations. It's not for corporations. Competitive taxes are important for business and business growth, which is important for jobs and wage growth. And you know, honestly, we should be ringing that alarm bell, every single one of you, every time we talk to a client.
That's an example of the arrogance. These people have billions, and they've got control of our government now. And so it's very corrupt, and the money power is very great. And they can buy and sell these politicians, and these bureaucracies are under their control and dominance now. And so that's how they can get away with this stuff. So-and-so didn't do this intentionally, and this didn't happen. And no, we can't bring charges. This was, by the way, this John Corazon scandal and so forth and bankruptcy was on Obama's watch. And this is Obama's Department of Justice and all that. So, you know, did he really go after the wrongdoers on this or not? No, he didn't. They excused everybody. They ended up with billions missing, and they were giving away, you know, they were given fines that were like a pat on the wrist, you know. But this is what's going on in Washington, D.C. And, I mean, it's just gotten so divisive and so forth. Anyway, I'm going to play a clip here coming up and to tell you how that deep state, according to Lou Dobbs, is attacking Trump. That's coming up in just a second right now.
My son is a wonderful young man. He took a meeting with a Russian lawyer, not a government lawyer, but a Russian lawyer. I think from a practical standpoint, most people would have taken that meeting. It's called opposition research, or even research into your opponent.
That was President Trump earlier today. He was in Paris responding to a question about Don Jr. meeting with this Russian lawyer last summer. Here with reaction, author of the new book, Putin's Gambit, from the Fox Business Network. Our friend Lou Dobbs is back with us. I just outlined in great detail the Ukrainian issue of influence and real collusion. Then, of course, you got the British Intel dossier. And Comey wanted to pay the guy with false information, and he was paying people for the information. But that's not what we hear about. What do you make of the double standard?
The double standard is more than that, I think, Sean, by a long measure. This is an effort to subvert the administration of President Donald Trump. It is nothing less. It is an effort by the deep state to roll over a duly elected president and a legitimate government and to break the will of the American people. This is no longer about Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals. This is about a full-on assault by the left, the Democratic Party, to absolutely carry out a coup d'etat against President Trump, aided by the left-wing media. The suggestion there's collusion between Trump and the Russians when we have absolute evidence of collusion between the Clinton Foundation, Secretary of State Clinton, and the Russians. I mean, this,
with
my
real
God,
money.
What does it take?
I don't know what it takes, but we've had 125 deep state leaks in 126
right.
days. Every one of them, I would say, needs to be investigated for being a felony. You see, I think the only way this works is the deep state gets purged.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, Obama holdovers get purged. That still has not happened. The next thing is the laws of the country that apply to every American watching us now, Lou, need to apply to Hillary, need to apply to Comey, need to apply to Attorney General Lynch, and anyone else who leaked information within the deep state. If we don't hold them accountable, then it never stops.
You're exactly right. And by the way, the evidence is recent history. Over the course of the last month, we have watched those leaks accelerate in point of fact. From the West Wing, the White House itself, instead of a bait. And we have a Justice Department. Where is Attorney General Jeff Sessions? This is a time for the Attorney General to stand up and say, this is not going to be tolerated, and this is what is going to occur. We're opening investigations into the Clinton Foundation, to Uranium One, and 20% of uranium production that was transferred ultimately to the Russians.
Well, Lou,
that's collusion.
But the question is, I don't know any other antidote than to purge the deep state, to apply the law equally. And if you don't, then you're giving license for all of this to continue.
You know, I do think we should, as you say, apply the law equally. But just to apply the law randomly to Democrats would be such a massive improvement, an order of magnitude better than what we have now. We have President Trump being investigated by a special counsel, and there isn't even a crime called collusion. Bob Mueller doesn't have any basis in legal...
We're going to have investigative creep. He's going to use Hillary's attorney to go further and further and set perjury traps.
Do you know what, Sean? It's interesting to hear the left-wing national media's narrative changing. This is going to be, quote-unquote, the new normal for 2 or 3 years as the Trump administration is investigated. They're actually saying that.
Four years, Lou. It'll be four.
I think you're right. But it should be stopped here.
All right, Lou Dobbs on our sister network, the Fox Business Network, every night, 7 Eastern.
See, that's the kind of men, Hannity and Dobbs, Lou Dobbs, John Hannity and Lou Dobbs, they stand up. They're standing up and telling it like it is. Now, these are the people that I respect, and that's why I'm playing these clips tonight, to give you in 1 hour here, this first hour of thesecrettruth.com, we're trying to put together a lot of differing kinds of topics and so forth. But also, we're standing up and defending President Trump. The deep state is financed with infinite money. And these are your intelligence agencies that are bureaucratically manned at deep levels, and they're already in there. And they have been mounting a tremendous assault. A coup is underway to get rid of President Trump. He knocked off the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. That was a no-no, according to the world elites and so forth, these national elites. And so you can see that they're in rebellion. And the next clip I'm going to play comes from an interview with Barry Diller out at the Sun Valley Conference that's just concluded out in Sun Valley, Idaho. And Barry Diller is very much a critic of President Trump. What's interesting is Ivanka Trump is there along with her husband, Jared Kushner, And Barry Diller is saying these very, very outspoken things about, he's married to Diane Fursten, von Fürstenberg, and they are very wealthy. They give $50-100 million grants and people, all, you know, and there's a park up in New York they've recently given $100 million to. So they have a lot of money. They're on the Democratic left, and they hate Trump. And his Trump is trying to bring jobs back and to rebuild America, America first, to make it better and so forth. And these people are adamantly against him. And they're all supporters of Hillary and so forth. And Chelsea and von Fürstenberg and Barry Diller were out on a yachting in the last 6 to 8 months somewhere. So they're all buddies and so forth. And they all go to these big parties in the New York area. And so they're really against his nationalism. Trump is a nationalist. He's trying to rebuild the country around that. And so they don't want that. They want to keep America down, to integrate it into this new world order. And that's basically what's been going on. This next clip is Barry Diller, and you'll understand the viciousness of some of these people that are against Trump. And he's sitting being interviewed out in Sun Valley at this conference in Idaho. Here we go right now.
And let's get to Julia Boorstin live at the event with Barry Diller, chairman of IAC and chairman of Expedia. Folks, take it away.
Thanks so much, Tyler. Really appreciate it. And Barry, thanks so much for joining us here on the Hilltop today. There's been a lot of conversation so far about the impact that President Trump is going to have on the businesses of all the CEOs here. You've been an outspoken critic of President Trump. What are the issues you're most concerned about right now?
Well, that he hasn't done anything, really. That, I mean, I think it's just a joke. And hopefully it'll be over relatively soon. It inexplicably began, and it'll inexplicably end.
Well, Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump are on the attendee list for Sun Valley.
Yes.
What would you advocate for when you see them here? Would you talk to them?
I'd say hello. I've been friendly with them prior to, of course, the current situation. But I can't blame them for the current situation. So, of course, I'll say hello.
Are there any issues you'd ask them to bring up with the president?
Utterly none. What would be the point? Bringing it up to somebody who has no curiosity, doesn't listen, et cetera. Why would anybody bother?
Well, there are very various issues, obviously, that will impact your company. Immigration,
yes.
Potentially. Tax reform. Do you think there is a potential positive impact from tax reform?
Well, of course there is. I think the reason the market is buoyant is because of expectations on repatriation, tax reform of one kind or the other. I mean, I think that it's a little less likely. I hope it happens. I've hoped it would happen during the Obama administration. I've always hoped it would happen. Certainly repatriation, which is a true craziness in terms of competitiveness and fairness. But I don't know. I think this administration will have difficulty getting anything done.
And what about the crackdown on immigration? Obviously, you're, as chairman of Expedia and IAC, are really in this tech space, which relies a lot on
yes,
sort of
yes, we've been very outspoken. And interestingly, we have a company called Trivago, which mm-hmm. is a very fast-growing travel company, which is founded and based in Germany. And this morning, the chairman of that company, founded it, wrote that they are having the easiest time recruiting employees from the U.S. And I've been hearing that a lot. So, in fact, we're going to lose talent rather than importing talent, which we always need. We have, you know, I think I heard we have 1 million or 2 million jobs in the future. That tech jobs that we simply don't have the workforce for
today.
So, I mean, I think it's look, it's the immigration policies are reprehensible.
Today is Net Neutrality Day of Action to try to draw attention to President Trump's net neutrality plans. How will his plans to roll back net neutrality legislation impact your companies and IAC in particular?
Well, I think net neutrality is the current accepted way. There is no question, though, that if you roll it back, that the magic of the Internet, I mean, it is a magic, is to press a button and you publish to the world without anybody between you and the person you publish to. That's a miracle. And that is net neutrality. Now, everybody who distributes over the internet, the big guys, of course, don't like that. Because the way they dominated media over the last century was out of scarcity and out of denial and out of saying, well, if you want to get on my distribution network, you've either got to pay me or I've got to own 50% of your company. So that kind of colonialism will be in great danger if there's no net neutrality. And our company, and we've incited every company we can find to speak out, it's just shocking to me that the American people would allow this miracle to be in danger. I think everybody, I really do think, with information, they are going to write to the FCC, they are going to be outraged by this, and I don't think that it'll get very far. I'm kind of confident that we will have net neutrality, but I'm only confident to the level that just ordinary people don't recognize that their free communications are going to be in danger.
About 2 years ago on CNBC, you thought that all TV news, with the exception of local news, was irrelevant. That was the term you said. Now that Trump's been attacking the TV news business, he's going after all of the TV players
what
with the
mean,
exception.
I said it was irrelevant?
Local television news was going to be the most important part of TV news. It was in 2015.
Oh, no. I said it's the one thing that I absolutely can guarantee will survive.
Will survive. But so what's your take on the news business now that you have Trump attacking the television
news
business?
Well, I think it's actually great for the news business. I mean, what's horrible, of course, is this idiocy of fake news and his choosing off news people and news. I mean, I'm saying the obvious. I mean, any bimbo would feel this way. So, but actually, because of the fact you kind of got to pay a little bit of attention today, and you're going to get it from all of these sources, good sources, bad sources, fair sources, unfair sources. This environment is very, very good for news, certainly good for investigative reporters.
Do you think Trump's criticism of CNN will prevent the AT&T Time Warner deal from going through, or will they have to sell off CNN?
I can't imagine it. I mean, anything can actually happen, but I doubt it. I mean, I don't. Listen, you do have, separate from Trump and a few of the other crazos in the administration, you know, you have pretty decent, smart people at work. And I don't think they're really going to say, because that bimbo president of ours thinks that CNN is the Antichrist, that it's going to prevent the Time Warner merger.
And I have to ask about Snapchat. Evan Spiegel, CEO of Snap, is here, and Snap is trading below its IPO price. What's your take on Snapchat? Do you think it has a chance to be a third big player next to Facebook and Google?
I don't know about third, but I'd pack it up there in the numbers. I mean, it has a big audience, and people like Snapchat. So, I mean, I think that there's a lot of hype. I don't think that any IPO is at all relevant until 3-5 years after, other than the people who sell off at the beginning or buy at the beginning and hold. So I think that time will tell, but I think Evan Spiegel, who runs it, is is brilliant. So he's got a good shot.
Would you buy Snap shares at this price?
I don't buy shares in publicly traded companies, other than in all of the ones that we own.
Okay, well, to be continued. Barry Diller, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Hey there, thanks for checking out CNBC on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on all of the day's biggest stories. You can also click on any of the videos around me to watch the latest from CNBC. Thanks for watching.
Well, the only thing that I have to agree with Barry Diller on is that he spoke about keeping the internet open, free and open. And he said these big concerns wanted to close it down and make it more of an exclusive rights for them to control it and regulate it. So we don't want regulation of the internet in any way. We don't want it under FEC control or the FCC or whatever, FCC control. We want it free and open for anybody to use as a means by which to convey any and all ideas, good and bad. And so that's Barry Diller there being interviewed up in there. And he doesn't like Trump at all. You know what I mean? And so he's totally, totally against him. going to talk a little bit now about Time Magazine. And what's interesting about Time Magazine is Henry Luce, okay, he was the founder in the early 1920s of Time Magazine, and it became a tremendously successful national magazine. And it even had distribution in other English-speaking countries and all over the world. So, and in this expansion of Time Magazine, he comes out of Yale, the University of Yale. He's a Skull and Bones member. He also, when he got married, he actually had a Skull and Bones wedding, they call it. And I'm going to play a clip of an individual that actually witnessed a Skull and Bones wedding, and that's going to give us sort of an insight into how that goes on. Okay, so coming up next is a Skull and Bones wedding, a description by someone that hid out in the loft of a barn building and heard the ceremony, and then she describes it in this audio. Coming up next is that. Here we go.
In 2002, Yale alumni Alexandra Robbins published a book titled Secrets of the Tomb, Skull and Bones, the Ivy League, and the Hidden Paths of Power, after several Skull and Bones members were willing to talk to her, albeit outer circle members, and while not being anywhere close to as groundbreaking as the 1983 book by Anthony Sutton, America's Secret Establishment, or the 2004 Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Secrets of the Tomb is actually quite interesting and quite revealing. One of the most interesting aspects that hasn't been covered really anywhere else is the fact that Skull and Bones has a secret wedding ceremony for the brides. After Skull and Bones members get married, they have an initiation ceremony for their wives to welcome them to the Skull and Bones family. Because, you know, behind every corrupt man is usually a woman willing to look the other way. On page 156, she says that a woman, a sister of a Bones bride, told her that she managed to watch the entire Skull and Bones wedding ceremony in the 1960s. About a group of 20 Bonesmen took the bride and groom to a barn at the end of the complex where the festivities were held. This is after their original wedding, and then they snuck off and did their own little satanic ritual. Quote, "Everyone was to be excluded, but I wasn't in the mood to be excluded," the woman said, "so she hid in a loft in the barn. During the ceremony, which was officiated by a patriarch in his mid-80s, the Bonesmen wore black hooded robes and chanted in strange languages. The sister peered down at the ceremony, her mouth agape, and as men waved an object that resembled a baton over a coffin and spoke about ghosts. Quote, it was weird, weird, weird. It was ritualistic, almost pagan. They went through this whole thing about how if any of them were to ever get in trouble, they would come to the rescue of their Skull and Bones and compatriots, including financially. There was an emphasis on the pledge to forever help out your brother," she said. "I remember thinking that it reminded me of a ceremony where you step up from Brownie to Girl Scout, which happens in, about second grade. But I was also slightly scared at the time because I was thinking that these guys, there were older people there too, really looked serious." The sister was apparently not scared into silence, however. Near the completion of the ceremony, she said that somebody spotted her, and at the end she said that she cried out that you men are full of bleep. Shocked, the bonesmen grabbed her, five or six of them ran up the stairs at the loft, and growled, "You are to never speak of this to anyone." "Are you threatening me?" she said. The bonesmen didn't answer. I was a bit intimidated. But if that's what they do in Skull and Bones, all the leaders of the free world, then we're in trouble. I'm 62 years old, and I don't think in my entire life I have ever been so stunned like that. It was just all too bizarre." Well, yeah, what can you expect? I mean, you know, behind every corrupt man's a woman willing to look the other way. But there you go. Few people know that ever since 1991, really 1992, I guess, Skull and Bones actually admits, or recruits, really, women, of course. There was a big faction in the Skull and Bones society that a lot of the patriarchs didn't want women to be allowed into the Illuminati Mafioso stepping stool postgraduate secret society. But ever since 1992, They have been choosing, just a few at least, women to help become a part of the Skull and Bones family, the Brotherhood of Death.
So there you go. That's a description of a Skull and Bones wedding. So anyway, Henry Luce and his wife were married that way after the official wedding ceremony. They went off and had this Skull and Bones wedding ceremony or so forth. So the Luces were described by some as being synarchist. And synarchist back in the early 30s and 40s were people that adhered to the idea that the political system should be dominated by, from behind the scenes, by secret societies. And so that's basically what we have today, is that the lodges, the Masonic lodges, and all these other secret societies are actually mystery school systems, are actually working to dominate and put into office people that are their followers or their initiates or their members, see. And so that's basically what we're dealing with today. And this is where we're up against a really, really very, very difficult situation in this country. We've had during the 20th century an indoctrination and transformation of the country from a pure conservative individualism type of an idea to much more on the collective left of a communist socialist collective left type of thinking. And I think Bernie Sanders exemplified this better than anyone else during the 2016 campaign. In his fight and battle for the Democratic nomination, he collected quite a following, and his crowds were larger, much larger than Hillary Clinton's. And so there's a large section of our population out there, a proportion of our population, that is on the collective socialist and even the extreme communist left. And they supported him. And I think that when he first started out, he started out in that vein. Now he's got some problems up in there in Vermont and so forth. And his wife has problems about some kind of a problem in a loan application and so forth. So I'm sure that he'll probably work his way through there. But anyway, getting back to the country as a whole, these large concerns, Time actually bought the Zapruder film from JFK. They did not widely distribute it. They have been accused of helping to cover up the JFK assassination. And now we have them putting on the front cover of Time magazine Donald Trump Jr.'s photograph. And did someone said recently it looked like that they put some kind of mustache on him, or they made a darkness underneath his nose, and then "I love it" was below that, was referring to something that he said in one of his emails. So now they're taking this red-handed, I think was the caption below on the lower part of the magazine, like he was caught red-handed in colluding, so forth. That's the story now, is that Donald Trump Jr. and others have been colluding, you know what I mean, with the Russians, and so the Russians have been using them to manipulate and to dominate are the outcome of our election. It just so happens that when Yeltsin was running for election in Russia, that Americans interfered with that election, and that's proven, and that's historical. So we as Americans have gone overseas with a lot of military actions. We have, through our CIA and other clandestine and intelligence operatives and agencies and so forth, we've done a lot of mischief overseas. And so are we going to sit here and then be critical of the Russians or Chinese as trying to do things against us? It's a given that they are out there trying to collect information, whether it's communications, electronic, whatever, surveillances, or communications, intelligence, you want to be signal intelligence, or human intelligence, that all of these factors are being utilized. Now it's moved up into a cyber type of warfare type of thing, where there's a warfare going on the web to extract from our databases and so forth as much as they can by some of the premier hackers in the world working for those governments. WikiLeaks had been publishing stuff, and they've come in for harsh criticism. Hillary, it cost her the race, what they were releasing. These are things that were unforeseen. She thought she had a lock on it. We've had just a couple of people recently that have died that were delving into her emails, and one was a Haitian that was going to testify before a Senate Intelligence Committee in Haiti, I believe. And he committed suicide. And then we have an older man up in the Chicago area that had been collecting up information on the Clinton emails. And he was suicided also. We don't know if there was legitimate suicide or not. I'm not making that allegation. I'm just putting it out there that there's the Hillary and Bill, when they went for the top of the heap, they didn't let anyone stand in their way. And so there's a lot of people that got hurt by that couple. And so anyway, they're to be careful and to be wary about. And that is part of this deep state, this swamp, this corruption. And these are examples now right in our face. And the problem with this thing now, like this Corazon thing, is that they just rub our face in it. It's no longer hidden, and people don't no longer get punitive sentences or sent to prison or anything else. The whole system has evolved, it seems like, to excuse each other. So instead of convicting the worst offenders in the group and so forth that have become public, then there's not enough public outcry that comes about to take these people and actually punish them. The public out there, are they asleep? We've been saying this for years. You know what I mean? Wake up, this and that. I mean, today, an individual in a restaurant pointed out that there was a group talking about werewolves or something. I don't know. The people get into to discussions about things that don't really matter in this world and in this country. And they're into this fictional thing. And that's where a lot of people are. They've been absorbed into the world of fiction and novels. And it gets them away from what's happening in this country today. And I've been noticing that and writing about it for years as a very, very disturbing trend. And I can't be more critical than I am already about it. We need to not get into this fantasy world and get out of that. That's but our young people are into computer games and this and that, and I mean it's all make believe, it's all made up stuff, and it doesn't do our country any good to get into that and get lost in that and get distraction. It's a distraction away from really what's going on. We need to get back to that money problem. We are both sides, the liberal Democrats and the conservative Republicans. We've got to start awaking up to some of the real problems that exist. I want to thank you for listening tonight, and we broadcast every Saturday night, 7 to 9, in Austin, Texas, on 89.1 FM. And our website is thesecrettruth.com. And I want to thank Deborah and Wes and everybody else for making this possible. Thank you and good night.